If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest, and I hope greatest ever episode of Life on Planet Porky, with myself, the Porkmeister, of course, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Extraordinaire, or Air.
Changed gender?
That's right. Leslie-Anne Jones. And Leslie-Anne, if my voice feels a bit rough this morning, today, as we... as record this last one before Christmas, it's because I'm afraid I've been whacked down by a cold, but delighted to be able to say it's not COVID. So, small mercies, I suppose.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, there's so much of it around at the moment.
Yeah, there is.
People,
yeah.
Two of my children are down with it,
yeah.
In different parts of London. Thankfully, not with me.
Well, yeah.
I'm sorry that they're not with me, but, that doesn't put me at risk because
yeah.
they're elsewhere. But, Yeah, that's Christmas scuppered for us, really, because they won't be through the quarantine period in time.
Sure.
So, Well, I mean, but anything can happen in the next half hour, as I keep saying.
Hmm.
They could lock us down before Christmas
yeah.
at this rate.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's, as you say, it's changing so rapidly by the minute. And there we are. But anyway, there we go. I've sent you a Christmas card, Miss Jones, but I don't think you'll have got it because I sent all my Christmas cards out 10 days ago, right? And I thought, you know, I don't seem to be getting much response to this. You know what I mean? Normally people send you a text or something, or they take a picture of the card you sent them and say, lovely card, thank you. And so I started making a few inquiries and not one single person out of about a dozen has got my card. They just haven't arrived.
Well, the postal system is on its knees because
they have
so many members of staff off sick.
Yeah.
We are getting two deliveries a week
right.
where
okay.
I live, which is a London postcode.
Yeah.
And of course, it radiates outwards. It gets less efficient the further out from London you go.
It's true.
So, I think a lot of people have given up sending cards because of this.
I think you may be right. What I'm going to do is, including to yourself, is I got some cards made, which I do every year. I'm just going to have to take a picture of one and I'm going to have to email them to people, you know, and say, and then they might get the card after Christmas or something like that, you know. But one of my friends who lives in Kent, where I think you're moving to soon, aren't you, Miss Jones?
Indeed.
Yeah, lovely. I sent her a text and said, hi, do you want to send me a text back saying we haven't had any posts for 5 days. And this is Christmas week, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but they're all off sick and they can't do anything about that. If they've got COVID in the post office,
yes,
you know, what are they going to do?
Well, exactly. I totally agree.
It's like people ordering gifts. I've had several parcels delivered to my house
right.
that aren't for me.
Right.
And have no idea who the person is. So I get on to the delivery companies. They don't want to know. As far as they're concerned, they've delivered something.
Mm.
They don't care whether it's for you or not.
Yeah.
So then you open the package. You find out which company it's from. You send an email to them. They never respond.
Mm.
They don't seem to care if this stuff is being delivered to the wrong address. And they don't even want you to send it back.
Yeah. Did you ever get your passport?
Yeah, in the end,
right.
I did, but
long
after yours.
Oh, right, okay, because I got mine eventually. You talk about that, right. So what happens is, talking about Christmas cards again, I get them made by the chap who looks after all the artwork for us, right, and he sent me a text saying they should arrive tomorrow morning. Then I get a text from the post office, which are now a privatised company, saying, we tried to deliver your package at 11 o'clock this morning. I was out. I was working in town. You can come and pick it up at the sorting office, right? So I then go to the sorting office the next day and I said, oh, hi, I've got a message here. And the guy said, so where's your card? I said, I'm sorry, what card? Anybody who tried to deliver you a package will have left a card. I said, no, honestly, there is no card. Well, you can't have your package then. I said, what do you mean I can't have my package? I've got an electronic notice saying you tried to deliver. Isn't that proof enough? No. I had to go back with my passport, right? But there's still no note. He said, I can't hand this over without the note because it's just company policy. Anyway, in the end, I got it. But there was no note. And you hear this so many times, don't you? We tried to notify you. We tried to ring the doorbell and all that. And it doesn't always happen.
I think they don't do it. I think they run out of cards or they forgot to bring them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I never have a problem. I always go. If I have to pick up a package from the post office, I always take my passport, my driving license, because they seem to be quite ready for you. You know, they're quite smug about it.
Yes,
they're waiting for you to say, no, sorry, I haven't got any ID.
Yeah.
So I always go with everything. Just in case.
That's a very good idea. Well prepared, Miss Jones, as always.
You know, I was in the guard guides, and I do know to arm myself with the necessary.
Absolutely, the girl guides. Can't imagine you.
I was. I was a Queen's guide.
The Queen's guide, yeah.
Yes, I was.
Not the Boys' Brigade, in the Scouts. I think if you were like a senior scout, you became a sixer or something, and one of my mates at school became a sixer, and he was like treated like a hero. I don't know what a sixer is, but I think it's a senior scout.
So you had a little patrol of six scouts or cubs underneath you, as it were.
Oh, really?
Family show, and that you would be the sort of leader of that little pack.
Oh, leadership qualities, eh? I was always picked out throughout my life, Leslie Ann, as a person with leadership qualities, as you probably could have guessed, you know. But anyway, there we are. Now,
well, having worked under you, I can vouch for that.
Miss Jones, come on, family show. Don't put innuendos into it this early on.
Was not an innuendo. That was a genuine comment.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, all right, as having worked for you. Strictly work for you, because although you were the leader of the pack at the time.
I think you have
a very dirty mind.
No, Miss Jones, I don't at all. You are just very flirtatious, and you get cheeky. And
I'm fed up, not hard up.
Oh God, that's nice, isn't it? anyway, I got stitched up by Mr. Jeremy Vine this week. I don't know if you noticed, but I took a bottle of Southern Comfort into the building when I was doing Jeremy Vine on Five, and as a gesture to the whole of the crew. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold, as you probably noticed. As just the whole of the crew, I took in a big bottle of Southern Comfort for them all. You see what I mean? It was, a Christmas present to say, great working with you all, thanks very much and all that. Anyway, as I was just coming out of my sort of dressing room, Jeremy was coming in. So I thought, oh, who better to give it to? Hi, Jeremy, how are you? Am I here? I said, listen, a present here for the crew and everybody. And, oh, it's so kind of you. And he took it and walked off and then came back and said, are you sure this is a present for the crew? I said, yes, why? He said, there's a label on it. I said, what? And I suddenly got a shiver down my back. You know, what do you mean there's a label on it? And the label said, thank you, Mike. So it's thank you. Do you see what I mean? And then a space, Mike, like from Mike. You see what I mean? But this was misinterpreted as thank you, Mike. And the insinuation was, grievous insinuation, that somebody had given me that bottle in a carrier and I had just passed it on to the Jeremy Vine on Five crew. I mean, that's a heinous crime, isn't it? Not something I would do.
Re-gifting, yes.
Re-gifting,
Re-gifting. This is—it's terrible etiquette. I think it's always wrong. It's inconsiderate. I'm not accusing you of having done it because I think that that's a plausible explanation that you've just given.
Yes.
But I think it's the wrong thing to do in general because it takes the thought out of giving, doesn't it?
Yes.
Presents are meant to be things that people cherish. They're not treated as stuff to get rid of.
Yeah.
And I think if you opened up your package and you don't like whatever they've given you, it's best to donate it or sell it.
Yes.
But don't kind of try and pass it on as a gift to somebody else.
Yeah. Well, I've got about 6 large bottles of Southern Comfort, right?
Who thinks you like Southern Comfort?
People who look after my
people
garden.
People who somebody gave it to last Christmas.
Yeah, that's right. My garden, look after my house. That's right, yeah.
And it's horrible muck. I don't know why anybody would ever drink it.
Well, I do sometimes very late at night if I've had a few and all that. But generally speaking, you're right. It's so sweet and sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like, what's the word I'm looking for?
It's sickly. Like it's actually quite sickly, isn't it?
Glue and that. So I thought to myself, well, they're only staying in the cupboard, so I might as well give it away. But I didn't re-gift it. It was something given to me. It was my property, my possession, and I certainly didn't leave it in the bag that it came to me in. You know, it's a terrible.
So you're admitting it now.
No, because I would have gone out and bought one to replace it and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, there we go. Ms. Jones, during your illustrious career, did you ever come across the Wurzels?
Yeah.
How
could we not come across the Wurzels? They were huge at one point, weren't they?
They weren't huge. I mean, they were just a novelty.
Well, they invented a whole new genre called Scrumpian Western.
Did they?
Yeah. Yeah. They had a sort of USP, which was they took popular pop songs of the moment and they changed the lyrics to always include cider and cheddar cheese.
Mm. Yeah, and Combine Harvester.
Combine harvesters.
You got a brand new key.
Yeah, the phrase "ooh-ah" came into it quite a lot, didn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, the reason I mention it is because their drummer, a guy called John Morgan, who's 80, has died, and they were just about to go out on tour. So he's like a Rolling Stone type, 80 years of age, going on tour, but to mirror the life and times of Charlie Watts, a very eminent drummer, of course, he's died, and that's a bit of a, bit of a shame.
Well, really. I mean, I don't mean to sound hard, but it's not that big of a deal. You can get a session drummer easily, like today.
Yeah.
There are plenty of them around, and they're very competent as well. Session musicians
always
are very competent because that's how they make their living.
Yes.
9 times out of 10, when a band goes on the road, they won't have the original lineup. They will have session guys standing in to perform live with them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, these guys were proper musicians. They were country folk musicians, and they became popular. It was a Melanie song that I've got a brand new combine harvester. It was, what was the original song?
Oh, I got a brand new
pair of roller skates.
Oh, roller skates, that's it, yeah, pair of roller skates.
Roller skates.
Roller skates, yes.
Roller skates.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was that. But, they had their moment, didn't they? And God bless John Morgan.
Yeah, absolutely. I am a cider drinker. Yes, John, we'll remember you on Christmas Day.
I like cider, by the way.
Yeah,
do you remember cider lollies?
No.
Oh, gosh, when I was at school,
yeah,
we could get cider lollies from the, you know, they had an ice cream van outside school.
Yes, obviously.
And they banned them for some reason, which I never understood.
Oh,
so we tried to make them at home with cider. You know those plastic things you get and you can make lollies at home?
Yeah.
And you stick a stick in and shove it in
the freezer. Yes, that's right, in the freezer.
But it never froze. So they must have put something else in them to make them freeze.
Oh, well, you see, that's like antifreeze, isn't it? That's why it doesn't freeze, because there's alcohol in it. There's alcohol in cider. It won't freeze.
Right, okay.
My mum used to make ice lollies in the freezer. Of course, for the first 6 years of my life, we didn't have a fridge. I didn't come from a deprived...
You had a freezer, but you didn't have a fridge.
No. For the first 6 years of my life, didn't have a fridge or a freezer. We had a larder. Or a scullery.
So what, were you born in the dark ages then?
No. And I keep saying to people, they say, oh God, were you born in a back-to-back tenement, you know, in Glasgow or something? I said, no. I said, born in Chester in a semi-detached house. I said, but nobody had a fridge, you know, and used to leave the milk outside in the winter to keep it cold. And then it would freeze and the milk would come out of the, you know, the bottle and stick up in the air and that kind of stuff, you know.
Oh, and the birds would peck the silver tops of them.
Yes, they would, yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Did you used to do that thing at school where you collected milk bottle tops and your mum had to wash them, scrub all the cream off, and then you kind of poked a hole in them and put them all on a string?
Yes.
And when you had a great long string of them, you took them in and they gave them to charity to raise money.
Yeah, I wasn't sure
that was
what
a funny thing we did, wasn't it?
Before, yeah. But no, so when we got a fridge, when we eventually got a fridge, my mum noticed there was a freezer compartment, just a little flap at the top, really, you know. And And she started making ice lollies for us, and it was brilliant. She made about six a day during the summer when we were on school holidays, you know, and they were all made of orange squash. They were absolutely lovely, you know. People used to come around to our house and we would hand out the lollies. But anyway, there we are. Now, Ms. Jones, I've taken in this week, I know you're not a great TV viewer, but I took in Simon Cowell's new show, and it's called Walk the Line, and I have to say it's absolutely dreadful, I think. And look, I've got huge admiration for Simon Cowell, massively successful, very wealthy, you know, dreamed up some of the greatest sort of variety shows in the history of television. But I think he's peaked, honestly. This Walk the Line is just dreadful.
Oh, well, I haven't seen it, obviously. So what's it about?
Well, you know, when I saw the title, Walk the Line, I thought, oh, at least he's gone away from just singing. Because all his shows are singing, aren't they? Does he do The Voice?
No, that's a rival channel, isn't
okay.
it?
Okay, he does The X Factor then, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
And that's singing, isn't it? Britain's Got Talent is mostly people singing. So, excuse me, it's all down to singing. But on this one, it's so complicated. Somebody comes on and sings and gets a vote from the judge. So I think it's five acts a night, and the winner goes forward to tomorrow's show. But the winner can also take £40,000 and go home with that prize money. But if he stays, the prize money if he wins the following day is about £120,000, okay? And it builds up to £500,000 on the last night. And it's so complicated because the winner sits to one side, then a new act comes in, and then you've got to decide whether to take your money or leave. And it's honestly, the not the worst thing about it, but one feature of it is that Dawn French is one of the judges, okay? And it looks so blinking incongruous because she's sitting there with Gary Barlow, you know, gifted musician, and a couple of other, Alicia Dixon, is it? Yeah, she's a singer.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, why is the Vicar of Dibley sitting in on this talent show? Because that's what it looks like. And she acts like the Vicar of Dibley. You know, she's all bubbly and making jokes and all that kind of stuff. It just didn't work for me. But anyway, there you go, as I say.
Well, the beef I have with television at the moment is that pretty much every time you put the television on, this is why I don't watch much telly, is that it's all the shows are about winning money. And it's just so boring.
Yes.
Why does everything have to be about winning money? Surely there are other motivations in life.
Yeah, well,
there's too much reality TV. There are too many what I call ordinary people on television.
Yeah, sure.
You know, not that are not known for some specific talent or skill.
Yeah.
It's just dragging people out of the public domain and who want to be stars desperately.
Yes.
And they want to make loads of money and, you know, live a rich life.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that to a point. But surely we deserve more than that as television viewers.
Yes. No, I think we do. That guy Bradley Walsh is on four times on Christmas Day and Boxing Day.
Yeah. Well, I can stomach. The only quiz game that I like to watch is The Chase.
Yeah, I like that as well.
Because I do feel that the questions aren't too simple and that you do learn something most days. And it's wonderful to see, for example, a celebrity team winning a bunch of money for a charity or for their individual charities.
Sure.
But people just winning money because they want to buy a camper van or because they want to go on a spiritual retreat and find themselves or, you know, they want to pay for the daughter's wedding or something.
Yeah.
I think that's all a bit cheap, to be honest.
Yeah, well, you may well be right. I thought you were a Pointless lady. I thought you always watched Pointless.
No, I got bored with Pointless.
Oh, did you?
It's all a bit samey, really.
Oh, God.
No, I much prefer The Chase.
Mm. I don't understand the
rules. I like The Chase because the chasers are very clever people.
They're
all sort of champion quizzes. And the breadth of their knowledge is absolutely astonishing.
I discovered one of the chasers.
One?
The one who's a barrister as well in real life. What's his
name? Oh, is it Mark?
It might be Mark. I don't know. But he...
No, Sean Wallace. I think Sean Wallace.
Sean Wallace.
The Dark Destroyer.
Oh, is that him? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Because when I was running Talk Sport, he got in touch and said that he'd won some football quiz somewhere, you know, and that he was an expert on football. And I said, OK, well, come in, invited him in. And we threw questions at him and he got them all right. And as a consequence, you know, we had him on two or three times, made a regular feature of it, and his career moved on from there. So my claim is that I discovered one of the chasers.
Well, that's really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was a big football fan, but he knew everything about football. It was terrific.
His knowledge, just general knowledge. It's astonishing.
It is,
and also you can watch their minds work.
Yes,
when they do that sort of final chase thing.
Yes,
so the team has a go, and then the chaser has a go.
Yes,
and sometimes they have plenty of time to play with because they haven't got that many points to try and beat for the team.
Yeah,
so they think about it. Mm. And you can almost see the machinations of the brain as they're trying to work out the answer.
I totally agree. And all the time when they hesitate, and some of them hesitate long periods of time, you're saying, just pass on it, just pass on it. And then all of a sudden they come out with the right answer.
Yeah.
And you think, golly, where did
they're
that
thinking
go?
About it. Yeah, they're scrolling through their brains.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to find the answer.
Exactly. Now, look, I read a piece in one of the papers this week about an amazing bloke called Howard Blake, okay? Does that mean anything to you, Howard Blake?
Yeah, I've met Howard a few times, actually.
Wow.
He's a very good friend of another friend of mine called Jonathan Morrish,
right,
who was Michael Jackson's right-hand man at Sony for 28 years. Mm. And Howard sometimes comes into the Groucho Club and we have a drink with him. He wrote The Snowman, famously.
That's what I mean. That's what he's most famous for. But in this piece, which I read in the paper, he's got copyrights on over 720 productions, music productions, half of which are TV adverts.
Yeah,
amazing?
That doesn't surprise me, yeah.
Yeah?
He's quite eccentric, I will say that.
Yeah.
It's odd having a conversation with him because he seems like he's got 20 pairs of eyes and the eyes are all looking in different directions.
Really?
Yeah, these people are often quite eccentric, you know, creatives.
Yeah.
They are, everything inspires them.
Yeah, absolutely. But imagine, you know, meeting the person who composed and wrote, "We're flying through the air." Sorry, the voice is a bit croaky.
Or walking in the air.
Or we're walking in the air.
Yeah.
Na, na, na. I mean, that's the most famous Christmas song of the modern
age.
It
is magnificent. The interesting little factoid on that is that, you know, everybody thinks that it was, what's his name? The boy who sang it.
Oh, yeah, Alid Jones.
It's not Alid Jones on the single.
Oh, isn't it? Who is it?
No, it's not. It's some other guy.
Oh, yes.
Don't know his name, but it's not actually Alid Jones.
Somebody not called Alid Jones, yeah?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Although he's the one who made it famous, but that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah,
he went on to have quite an interesting career, didn't he, Alid Jones?
Yeah, he's kind of dropped down. Does he now have a show on a music station, I think, once a week or something like that?
Yeah,
I don't know.
He presents things like... it's not Stars on Sunday or one of those religious programs where, you know, they go to a different church every week.
Right, okay.
I can't remember what it's called, but they present a sort of church service.
Something on Sunday, is it? Songs on Sunday or something?
Yeah. Do you remember when Jess Yates used to do that?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And everybody thought he was Paula Yates' dad, and then it turned out that wasn't her dad, it was Huey Green.
Huey Green, I know. What an amazing story that was. But this guy, Howard Blake, he said in this interview, "I always try to make sure I've got at least £1 million in the bank." Well, we'd all like to, we'd all like to sort of be in that position. And he says, "Every now and then I get a cheque for £150,000 for royalties." And he's still making about a third of £1 million a year, I think, on walking in the air, you know.
Oh, I'm sure, because every now and again they reinvented a bit. They brought one out a few years ago called The Snowman and the Snow Dog.
Yes.
So the whole thing gets a new lease of life,
which
is fine.
Yeah,
yeah, because kids love it. Mm. The Snow Dog is very charming, actually. If you haven't seen that, I thoroughly recommend it.
Really? Yeah.
But it's a bit of a crass thing to say that you don't want your bank account to go below £1 million, because millions of people out there are subsisting below the poverty line at the moment.
Millions of people out there have to exist on like a £100 overdraft, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So far from getting £1 million in the bank. But no, I like successful people, you know. I think successful people are good people, they're entrepreneurial, they create wealth, they give us all a reason to try harder and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I like people like Howard Blake. I'd like to meet him. Next time you meet him in the Groucho Club, I hope I'm there to see him. But anyway...
one day when life gets back to normal, if it ever does, and we can just wander in and out of the Groucho anytime we like, then you'd be more than welcome.
Yeah, God, that would be something, wouldn't it?
Seems like another country, that, though, doesn't it?
Seems
really
like a different age altogether, I totally
agree. Yeah, we've got so used to staying in, being on our own, just not socialising, I used to have a lot of friends, and I feel as though I don't have any friends anymore.
Yes.
Because I never see anybody.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I haven't seen people for 18 months or 2 years. You're absolutely right. What was I going to say? This time of the year, I always get irritated as a journalist because I can't stand the, you know, annual review or the yearly review. Or
Tell me about it.
I just can't stand it. One of the so last weekend, one of the Sunday papers gave over its whole colour magazine to a review of the year. What a load of bollocks. It's just lazy journalism. You know, just scrape together all the best stories of the year. But I don't want to read about them. I've read about them when they happened, you know?
Do you know what that's like? You know the Week magazine?
Yes.
That thing that's kind of a roundup.
Yes, I do.
Which has always irritated me because they just steal the stories that have appeared in other papers.
Yeah, I know.
And they don't pay anybody for them. So no. The journalists don't get any royalties for the stories that they just pick up and use again.
That's right.
I think it's a really shameful publication, that. But these roundups are the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
As you say, you've read it all before. Why do you want to read it again?
Yeah, no, honestly, I just think, and I just throw it away. And I'm reading all that. I've read all that before. When I was running things at the Daily Express, I would never allow annual reviews. I said, don't do it. Get me something new. People don't want to read this. They read it in March when it happened and all this kind of stuff.
Quite right. And I tell you who did one, and I'm a big fan of Piers Morgan, as you know, massive fan.
Yes.
But he did one because he was leaving the Mail on Sunday,
wasn't he,
at the weekend. And so he did a sort of my best stories of all time kind of thing.
Yes.
Which, you know, is okay. And it probably wasn't his idea to do that, but they just wanted their pound of flesh before he left.
He did it over 2 days. I think he did it over last Saturday and last Sunday. And
yeah, he
You're absolutely right. You know, I love Piers to bits. I've worked with him. You know, I've actually been his boss when he was running the Bizarre column. But
he's been my boss.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, of course he has, at the News of the World, mm-hmm. And, you know, he's been very successful. He's going to go on to be even more successful. But I have to say, I only got halfway through the first episode of his, you know, Greatest Ever Stories before I realised I'd read all these before and I didn't read the rest of it and I didn't read it the following day, you know. But that's not to say that Piers isn't very good at what he does. He is, you know.
Well, he's about to be a global superstar.
Yes, that's right.
Because he's got his big new television deal, which I didn't realise it's going out on Fox Nation in America, Talk TV here, and on Sky News in Australia.
Yes.
So that is global, isn't it?
It is,
but
absolutely.
The thing I can't understand, I know he's going to do a column for the New York Post,
yes.
which, of course, Murdoch owns as well.
Yes.
And HarperCollins, they're going to do a follow-up of his book, Wake Up, which came out recently.
Yep.
The bit I don't get is why he's doing a column in The Sun. The Sun is such a rag these days.
Well, that's a bit harsh considering you and I have worked for it over the years.
Have you looked at it lately? It's got about 10 pages.
Yeah.
Really, there's nothing in it to read.
Yeah.
It used to be a fat, substantial newspaper, which, you know, regardless of your politics, it was a feisty read, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Trevor Kavanagh.
With lots of great pictures, lots of wonderful headlines.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can't see how they're going to reinvent it unless they put loads of money behind it, which presumably Murdoch's not going to do at this point.
Well, you don't invest in newspapers these days because
they're
such rapid decline. You know,
so why does Piers want to appear in The Sun?
Well, it's part of the deal, isn't it? Because as you quite rightly said, all the TV stuff is Murdoch, and now he's had to move from the Daily Mail group to the Sun group and in print. And so, you know, it's just part of the package, I suppose. But there we are.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the Rock Chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, we haven't even made reference to the fact yet that this is the last one before Christmas, because Christmas, of course, is tomorrow.
Where did that go?
Yeah.
I mean, last time I looked, it was last Christmas, and a whole year seems to have fled by.
Absolutely.
People are saying, I'm not ready for Christmas. Yeah. What are you going to be ready for, really? It's a dinner, isn't it? It's one day, a meal around the table, church for some of us.
Yeah.
It's all become a bit routine because it's unreliable now.
Yes.
We don't actually know whether it's going to happen.
Well, it's only got 24 hours to go, so we have to hope that
anything could happen in the next half hour, as I keep saying.
Yeah, no.
What was that, by the way? Was that Stingray?
Stingray?
Yeah. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Do you remember? On Stingray, the guy used to go...
Stingray.
Yeah, that one.
Stingray. Yeah,
the guy used to go, at the beginning, who was the kind of boss guy of Troy Tempest? And he used to go, anything could happen in the next half hour.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
At the beginning.
And it often did. Do you remember the female heroine was... Marina.
Oh, Aquamarina. Wasn't she beautiful?
She
was gorgeous.
Oh, Troy
but she had the same face as Lady Penelope, you know.
Yes, she did. That's right. It was the same.
So they obviously redressed that puppet in bits of sort of blue and green wafty stuff.
That's right.
To make her look like a mermaid.
Yeah. But even as a kid, I couldn't work out how Troy Tempest could get it away with a mermaid. You know what I mean? It used to...
How does that add up exactly?
Yeah.
No, but she had legs, Marina, didn't she?
No, she was a mermaid.
No, she wasn't. She didn't have a tail.
She did. She did, definitely.
I don't remember. I thought she had legs.
I remember her sitting at the lunch table with Troy Tempest, you know, candlelit and all that romantic evening, and she was definitely a tail.
I'm going to look that up because I think she had legs and her legs used to flap up and down when she swam. I'm going to look at that.
Check that one out, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. Now, Miss Jones, you've just referred to the fact that some of us go to church on Christmas Day, and I'm sure you'll be there as a staunch Christian and church warden. What have you ever seen the film, The Last Temptation of Christ?
No, I haven't. Interesting. But from talking to our last rector, who used to be at St. Bride's before our current rector.
Is that Canon John Oates?
No, Canon John was the previous one, but we had David Mirror in between.
Yes.
And David gave a sermon, having seen The Last Temptation of Christ some years ago now.
Right.
And it was quite graphic, the description of it. I didn't like the idea of a maggot crawling out of Jesus's nose and things like that. You know, it just seemed a bit graphic to me, and I didn't want to see it. I don't like things that upset me.
No.
I didn't want those images in my head.
Yeah, I didn't know about maggots crawling out of Jesus's nose.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it, but it's on telly over Christmas, right? I saw it in the TV listings, and I thought,
I
wonder whether I'm brave enough to watch that. But the main point of intention seems to be that it indicates that Jesus had sexual urges towards women. Doesn't make him a bad person, does it?
Well, no, of course not. But of course they weren't there. These writers and directors weren't there. This is only their view, their interpretation.
Yes.
How can they possibly have known?
Mm-hmm.
These people are always trying to sex things up to attract viewers.
Yeah.
There were more important things to focus on about Jesus Christ than whether he had a sex life or not, I think.
Well, you're right.
Look, he is the central figure of Christianity.
Yes.
Whether people like it or not, it is the world's largest religion.
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing, of course, is he was a first century Jewish preacher.
Right.
Religious leader, which has led to a whole other religion. And there's a lot of argument about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
The argument about faith and religion, the bottom line is very simple. Faith is about belief and hope.
Yeah.
And religion is cultural. It's the ways in which faith is celebrated and upheld.
Okay. So
we can't really argue and say, oh, we don't like Christians, we don't like Jews, we don't like Muslims because. Frankly, these are all the same thing.
Yeah.
These are all interpretations of belief in one central figure.
Right, okay. And there you are, folks. We knew we'd get a Christmas lecture, sermon from the Rockchick writer extraordinaire, babbling on about faith and religion and all that.
I'll pipe down now.
No, take that into your Christmas holiday with you and feel better about yourself. Now, I was reading a review of a new show. You were talking about the only thing on telly is quiz shows and all that. And this is done by old Jimmy Carr, okay? I've never really found Jimmy Carr very funny, to be honest, but I think that's because his humour is way above my head. You know what I mean?
I don't like his laugh. It gets on my tits. It really does.
Miss Jones, for
goodness sake. Sorry, but it's that sort of yearning, groaning kind of supercilious laugh. It just is really irritating.
Yes, yes, as you say. Anyway, the point of the story is, his new show is called I Literally Just Told You. It's on Channel 4, okay. And in a recent episode, one of the contestants was presented with a multiple choice question to which the answers were either Prince Charles, Prince Harry, or Prince Andrew. And the contestant named Amira, who's 24, said, "I'm not sure who Prince Charles is." I mean,
can anybody be that ignorant out of touch?
You know, if somebody was 14, they'd know who Prince Charles is, but somebody 24 years of age doesn't know who Prince Charles is. That can't be real, can it?
Well, it can't be, because, I mean, is anybody that out of touch, as I just said?
Yeah.
Surely if they put the television on once a day, or they listen to the radio in the car,
yeah,
or they pick up a newspaper, whatever,
yeah,
or they're staring at their phones all the time,
yes,
you're going to see a news headline every couple of days that involves Prince Charles.
Yeah.
So how can they possibly not know who Prince Charles is?
I've honestly no idea. Anyway, there we go. Talking about that, I was horrified to discover this week that if the whole of the royal family got wiped out, so, for instance, supposing they were having Christmas lunch at Sandringham, but Sandringham's roof fell in on them all, okay? Mm-hmm. But the Duke of York wasn't there because he's expelled from the family for, you know, all the reasons we know about, and neither was Harry and Meghan, because they're, of course, exiled now in America. The Duke of York would become king and Harry would be the next in line to the throne. That's a pretty horrifying scenario, isn't it?
Oh, God, that is. Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
At that point, I suppose this country gives up on a monarchy and becomes a republic.
Yeah. Well, the reason I mention this is because apparently the Queen has now asked William never to fly the family all together in a helicopter, because if that helicopter comes down, boomf, you've wiped out a generation of the royal family. That's pretty standard, isn't it, for, you know, people who are related to each other, or businessmen and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? If a helicopter or plane goes down, you wipe out the whole firm. I've heard about that before.
Well, there have been a few dreadful helicopter accidents in recent years where entire families have been wiped out.
That's right. I totally agree.
And so you never fly all a family in a helicopter.
Well, you shouldn't, should you? There was the bloke who ran a company called Compass, I think it is, and that used to supply food to aircraft at airports all over the world. It was the biggest. It was a British-based company, biggest supplier of food aboard aircraft around the world. And he took the family to Australia, and they were in a helicopter, all of them in a helicopter, flying, you know, out of Sydney or somewhere around there and up a valley to explore, you know, some, you know, the Blue Mountains or something like that. The helicopter came down, and you're absolutely right, the whole family was wiped out, and it was £1 billion fortune involved. Mm. Amazing.
It's a horrific, horrifically dangerous thing. But
yeah.
I have worried about William doing this for quite a few years, actually,
really?
Now.
Mm.
Yeah,
mm.
Because they are precarious things. We all know somebody who's lost their life in a helicopter crash.
I know several.
So I think it is wrong for the heir to the heir, as it were, to be flying these machines now.
Yes, no, I totally agree. The other thing I remember, what was I going to say? Oh, yes, years ago, the top people in secret intelligence in Ulster at the height of the Troubles flew in a helicopter, a Chinook helicopter, which is the one with two rotors, one at the front, one at the back, which carries troops and all that.
They're big beasts, aren't
they? Yeah, they are. Flew from Northern Ireland to a secret meeting in Scotland. Fog came down and the aircraft, as they call it, the Chinook, hit a cliff top, and they were all wiped out. 16 of the top members. And since that day on, of course, you know, they've decided now only fly two at a time or something like that.
Terrifying. I wouldn't get in one again. There have been too many accidents recently.
No, I totally agree. Now, I saw a feature recently, Miss Jones, and it's about a new TV documentary coming up. Giles Brandreth, sorry, I've worked with Giles, he's a very nice guy. And Giles Brandreth exploring the life and times of Charles Dickens. Has Charles Dickens been big in your life?
Yeah, obviously. We all studied Charles Dickens at school, didn't we?
Yep.
A few novels.
Yep.
If we did them to O level in English, but those of us who did English to A level.
Yes.
Obviously took on a few more books. I think he was very influential because of so much that he revealed in his stories about the underworld of poverty and struggles and so on. They led to reforms in this country.
Yes.
He exposed corruption of politicians and the judicial system and so on, and put people under intense scrutiny, and very strong characters who inspired people. So schools were founded, hospitals, charities, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he was a bit of a bastard in real life.
He was actually, yeah.
He was a ruthless Victorian husband. And he also, when he was having an affair with a young actress, he tried to have his wife, Catherine, declared mad and committed to a lunatic asylum.
Well, that's a bit harsh.
Yeah, very harsh.
Yeah.
But he had he lived this life, which on the outside was a very benevolent one, and he was a kind person, compassionate moralist, and all the rest.
Yes.
But he couldn't put up with the idea that his wife, who'd given him 10 children, by the way, that she'd lost her good looks and she was growing old, completely normal, didn't fancy her anymore.
Oh,
so he wanted to ship in a new bird. And that's what he did. Wow. And there is proof of this because letters were written.
Yeah.
Which are kept at Harvard University.
Harvard, yeah.
And you know Claire Tomlin, who's famously his biography. She says, controversially, that
Claire Tomlin, yeah, I know her,
yeah. That it was actually Charles Dickens who was mad, not his wife. And she said this, he told startling lies about his wife's condition, but he had fallen in love and his life was a mess. He was mad and shameful.
Goodness.
And of course, we know the 19th century was a very brutal place for the vast majority of people. But what we have to thank Charles Dickens for is for having chronicled it so that we know about it and we could put things right.
And the beautiful writing. I think one of the first serious books I ever read was David Copperfield, you know, and it weaves such magic patterns in your mind, you know what I mean, of the Dickensian lifestyle and all that, you know, ever so
wonderful often. Language. And, of course, at this time of year, we always have a story, The Christmas Carol.
That's right, yeah.
You know, which, I tell you what, this sounds a silly thing to say, but the best version of that, and I watch it regularly with the kids at Christmas, is the Muppet Show version.
Oh, really?
With Michael Caine playing Scrooge.
Really?
It's wonderful. Goodness. It's very, very uplifting. My grandmother used to love it as well.
The last person I remember who tried to put his wife into a lunatic asylum so he could start, you know, shagarooning around with a lot of other women was J.R. Ewing in the
Because Sue Ellen. Wasn't that? That was such compelling Sunday viewing, wasn't it?
Fantastic. Dallas. Fantastic. Loved it. I loved Dallas. It was my favourite ever TV series, Dallas. Peaky Blinders, and just finished last week, Succession, which is a most amazing production, and it's finished now. But you know, I know you don't watch a lot of telly, but it is.
I haven't seen Succession yet, but I'm saving it. For when I finish this current manuscript, I'm going to sit down and binge watch the entire thing.
Well done. Talking about authors, by the way, I came across another thing. Oh, by the way, you said Dickens had 10 children. I read a piece a few days ago about a woman who's got 22 children.
I know.
And she's now said, oh, I think I'll stop now. I mean, how on earth can you live with 22 children?
Well, there's something wrong with somebody who feels they need to draw attention to themselves by having so many kids.
Well, no, she says she gets broody whenever she's given birth.
You know, everybody gets broody. We all got broody. But frankly, it's not very good for the planet. The reason we're in the mess we're in is because of overpopulation.
It's absolutely true.
That's why we have viruses taking over.
Yeah.
So she's not done the planet any favours by having all those kids.
No, I just...
I've had three kids and I feel guilty about that. Not that I'd be without any of them. Of course I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, if we all as adults replaced ourselves, i.e. if every couple had two children, so when we die, we've just replaced our own beings in the world.
Yes.
If everybody restricted themselves to two kids, we would not have a problem going forward.
No, I totally agree. You know, famine happens because there's too many people and not enough food. I mean, for years in China, you could only have one child, couldn't you? But now...
Then they had to reverse that because the population was dying out.
Exactly what I'm saying. Now they reversed it and said, have as many children as you want. Talking about authors, we're talking about Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
Next year is the 125th anniversary of the birth of Enid Blyton. And I will celebrate that because I don't care what people say about Enid Blyton now and, you know, inherent racism in her books and sexism and all that. Enid Blyton lit up the world for me when I was a little kid. I read every book in the Secret Seven and Famous Five series.
Interesting, because I don't know whether you've read any of the writings of her daughters,
no.
Gillian and Imogen.
No.
They describe her as an arrogant, insecure, pretentious woman.
Yeah, but they said about Agatha Christie. I mean, they're successful.
Yeah, but the point is here. No. The point is here that she was a terrible mother.
Right.
And they said that she had no trace of maternal instinct whatsoever. Hmm. So this woman who was writing stories at a rate of knots, by the way, this is what impresses me about her.
Yeah.
She wrote 10,000 words every day.
Golly.
And she wrote 23 books a year. 23 books a year, which is unbelievable. I struggle to finish one.
Yeah.
You know, that, and that's me working flat out full time.
Yeah.
And
well,
she
wouldn't have to do research. It all comes out of her imagination.
Well, that's exactly. It's a whole different discipline, isn't it? Yeah. Writing nonfiction. But her kids had a succession of nannies who ignored them and they were very lonely. It just seems to me ironic that somebody who was so beloved as a children's author couldn't stand the sight of her own kids.
Yeah, well, I always wondered about Mrs. Thatcher's motherly instincts. I could never imagine Mrs. Thatcher picking up one of her children. She had two, didn't she? She had twins.
Yeah, Carol and Mark.
Carol and Mark, that's right.
And Mark was lavished with love and attention.
Yes.
She absolutely adored him, but Carol was ignored.
Yeah, that's larger.
And my
story.
Father got to know Carol Thatcher actually because
really?
They were all at the Olympics in Canada. Must have been the Winter Olympics.
Yeah,
some years ago,
mm-hmm.
and she was there as a journalist covering the Olympics for one of the papers.
Yes,
and my father, his friend Hugh McIlvenny, and Carol used to go out for dinner quite often.
Oh right.
And my dad said the stories that she told.
Mm.
You know, her mother was a loathsome creature. Because she she disliked Carol so much.
Well, Mrs. Thatcher disliked her daughter, Carol.
Yes, she did, yeah. And Carol, if you remember, she used to be on television quite a lot, didn't she?
Yes, she was,
years ago.
Yeah.
And she seemed quite an awkward person, a bit gauche. And
I know what you mean. She seemed unhappy in her own skin all the
exactly,
time.
Exactly. Which, if you've been unhappy since you were a little girl, that doesn't give you much of a future, does it, really?
No, is she still alive, Carol Thatcher? Because I haven't
seen
her.
Yeah, she is, but she doesn't. She's not out there anymore.
I think
she got married, actually.
Did she?
I'll have to look her up.
When Mrs. Thatcher died, she left quite a substantial fortune, I think, because we haven't heard anything from Mark or Carol since. Mark Thatcher, on the other hand, was just a complete deadbeat, honestly.
The thing that upset me about him is that he was an arms dealer and she was sanctioning it. Now, how could that ever have been right?
It was that deal, wasn't it? The dam. There was a dam they built in the Middle East somewhere and he brokered it, got about 10 million quid, but his mother pushed the deal through. No, you're absolutely right. We spent some time chasing him around America when he had a new girlfriend in Texas, you know. And it was
he married her, didn't he, that blonde?
The one we were chasing him around, he didn't actually marry her because her father was a second-hand car dealer of a dubious sort of background, you know what I mean?
Dear.
And he was warned off by the British government. But, we all went down to a restaurant called The Caravan of Dreams in Fort Worth, you know.
That is a great title for a novel,
Caravan
of Dreams.
Yeah, that was the name. Too.
I might write that one.
Good idea. And, of course, we all flew there from New York or from California or even from London, you know, to root out this new romance of Mark Thatcher. And, you know, we all surreptitiously booked a table in the Caravan of Dreams. Of course, when we got there, we found the only people in there were all our mates from Fleet Street or California or New York. And Mark Thatcher and his new bird never turned up, you know.
They got wind of you lot.
Yeah, they must have done, yeah. Such was the way of the world in those days. Can you imagine now flying a reporter out from London to a restaurant in Fort Worth, Dallas, on the belief that Mark Thatcher may have a new girlfriend? I mean, they wouldn't send a reporter to Brighton these days for the same job.
They wouldn't send you to Ludgate Circus.
No.
I mean, in those days, we were sent all over the place on the most spurious excuses.
Totally agree.
The money that used to be spent.
Yeah.
Nowadays, everybody's got somebody on the ground at the other end.
Yes, that's right. No, I totally agree. I remember Huey, whatever his name was, he went on to become the editor of The Express. Do you remember a guy? Blonde hair.
Hugh Whitto.
Hugh Whitto, thank you. Fancied himself almost as much as Mr.
Nice man, actually. I always got on well with Hugh.
I did as well, but he had a huge ego and he used to, you know, really play on the fact that he was very handsome and all that kind of stuff. But he was once on a golf course in somewhere like, you know, the home county, Sunningdale or something like that, when some guy came out from the clubhouse and said, could you ring your office? He rang the office and they sent him to Australia on some spurious story about Tom Jones or something, having, you know, a girlfriend on his arm while his wife was back home in Wales or wherever they lived, or California, wherever she lived. And he got there about a day after Tom Jones had left and gone home, and he just flew home.
Oh, crazy.
You know, club class there and back.
Yeah. It's sort of almost we shot ourselves in the foot, didn't we, in a way?
Yeah.
Along came the internet, and that was it. No more travel.
No more travel for any of us. Right. Okay, Miss Jones. Well, thank you very much indeed. It only remains for us, and I'll go first, to wish all our listeners a very, very happy Christmas. Thank you very much indeed for having listened to us throughout the year, and we hope there'll be many more to come. I personally just want to say I hope you have a great couple of days at home with your family, and please take care.
Yes, Merry Christmas, everybody. Thank you for listening all this year. It's been wonderful having you. And stay safe, stay sane, have a happy time, and see you in 2022.
Absolutely. First 6 years of my life, didn't have a fridge or a freezer. We had a larder or a scullery.
So what, were you born in the dark ages then?
No. And I keep saying to people, they say, oh, God, were you born in a back-to-back tenement, you know, in Glasgow or something? I said, no. I said, born in Chester in a semi-detached house. I said, but nobody had a fridge, you know? Aquamarina.
Wasn't she beautiful? She was gorgeous.
Oh, Troy
Temple. She had the same face as Lady Penelope, you know.
Yes, she did. That's right. It was the
so
same.
They obviously redressed that puppet in bits of sort of blue and green wafty stuff.
That's right.
To make her look like a mermaid.
Yeah. But even as a kid, I couldn't work out how Troy Tempest could get it away with a mermaid. You know what I mean? It used to, you know, used to sort of...
How does that add up exactly?
Yeah.
No, but she had legs, Marina, didn't she?
No. No, she was a mermaid.
No, she wasn't. She didn't have a tail.
She did. She did, definitely.
I don't remember a
remember
tail. I thought she had legs.
I remember her sitting at the lunch table with Troy Tempest, you know, candlelit and all that, romantic evening. And she was definitely... A tail came off.
I don't think so. I'm going to look that up because I think she had legs, and her legs used to flap up and down when she swam. So I'm going to look at that.
Yeah,
check
that one out. But I'm pretty sure I'm right. The last person I remember who tried to put his wife into a lunatic asylum so he could start, you know, shagarooning around with a lot of other women was J.R. Ewing.